Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Bryn Jones.
Thank you.
Well, welcome. You've been North Fremantle in effect, councillor on a few occasions. Your most recent election, I think, is from 2015?
2015, yeah.
And before that in the 90s, Bryn?
93 to 99, so the three-year terms then, so 2 3-year terms. Then I retired because my girls were getting to upper school, high school age, you know, exams and so on, and I thought I was away from home too much, so I retired and then came back in 2015, and I've just been re-elected. So it's now my 11th year.
Well, congratulations. I'm always fascinated when I meet people like you and your colleagues on the council and in other positions where it requires people to decide to become a candidate for public office as to what drives them to this selfless service, because sometimes the public has a sort of a more caustic view about these things and assume all sorts of self-interest and the like, but I don't have that impression at all. What got you going in the first place?
I think it was mostly planning issues in North Fremantle, though we had a very strong precinct group in the early 90s, and we had a lot of those issues which are still issues, you know, roads, railways, beaches, development. So there's always been a lot of pressure in North Fremantle. There's always been a lot of big issues going on with Leighton Beach and things like that. So I think it was most of the planning issues. And I was involved in the precinct group and was actually asked by a group of people if I'd consider standing because they thought that the council of the day wasn't dealing very well with the planning issues, specifically for North Fremantle. And similar issues again in 2015. We had the North Ward is half in North Fremantle and half south of the river between Cantonment Hill and the netball courts, roughly. And so it was kind of bookended by these two developments, both of which were unpopular. There was the Matilda Bay brewery site, which was slated to be 11 stories, and then the Burt Street Landcore development, which was not so invasive, but there was a lot of opposition to it from the residents. So it was again those issues that some people again approached me and said, would I think about standing for council again, because they weren't happy with the way planning was going. So
just on that topic for a moment, major developments, I'm always nervous to mention the word as it's become JDAP.
Yeah.
But to what extent does Frio have control over major developments, particularly of the two that you just mentioned?
Well, less so now. I mean, the emergency powers, it's anything over 20 million can opt to go to the state government, and we don't quite know the details of that. They can apply now, but we don't know whether Fremantle council officers will even write the report. So the JDAP, over a certain value, the developer can opt to go to JDAP rather than the council decision, and over a higher value, they have no choice. It has to go to JDAP. And JDAP is three nominees of the government and two nominees of the council. So we're always in a minority. I'm a reserve member, so I don't go very often. So the council officers prepare the report. In some councils, the elected members don't even get to comment on it or to be involved in it at all. The council officers prepare it and send it to JDAP. In Fremantle, we have it come to the planning committee, but we can't change the recommendation. We can add our own comments to it. So effectively, the officers make a recommendation. The elected members can add comments to it or suggest changes to it, and then it goes to JDAP with both of those components. And really, it's all the JDAP memberships changed recently, so I haven't met any of the new members, but they made the areas bigger, had less committees, and we've now got different people. So we haven't done too badly out of the JDAP process recently. I think they have only one issue I can remember was an apartment block next to St. Pat's, which the council recommended for refusal, and JDAP approved it. And it hasn't been built anyway, but and apart from that, they've tended to agree with us, so it's not been as bad as we might have thought. Of course, now If we go to the state system, we don't even know if council officers will get to write the report.
Yes. So that's this sense that local governments always have, that they quickly pruned, their powers are taken from them, and you see some councils round about where the administration or the commissioners are put in to run it. What's your take generally on local government? Is it still functioning well?
I think people greatly overestimate our powers. I think that's one of the issues. People are often frustrated with what the council does, but so many issues are either involve multiple agencies or they're controlled by state agencies, and our powers are nowhere near as great as people like to think. So they say, for instance, why are you letting them build a pub? Why don't you make them build something else? Well, of course, you can only determine the things that people ask you to determine. You can't tell them to go away and do something else. So I think that's frustrating, particularly with issues like main roads we have now with the bridges and so on, that they are a very difficult agency to deal with in our experience, and they seem to have an awful lot of power and an awful lot of money. And the whole issue with the speed limits on South Terrace, that's a good example of how for 2-3 years we've been trying to do what Main Roads told us to do to get a speed limit reduction, and then they just went and changed the policy. It's very, very frustrating. I didn't even make an exception of the fact that Fremantle was 3/4 of the way through the process.
Well, I always like to remind people who don't know this that, of course, it was Main Roads Department through Mr. Hepburn as the commissioner, along with Professor Stevenson, who came up with the Hepburn-Stevenson report, which became the Metropolitan Region Scheme. And once you put all the roads in, of course, everything follows, and Main Roads are still there. Just you've touched on the question of the traffic bridge. There are proposals right now and meetings later this week in Fremantle to talk about what's happening. This affects North Fremantle rather directly, I think, doesn't it?
Yes, particularly the town centre. So it's pretty complicated, but what we wanted the government to do is to take the whole planning of the North Fremantle Peninsula and look at it in a holistic way, which involves Curtin Avenue, which is the road on the other side of the railway, which ultimately is supposed to be the main road into Fremantle rather than Stirling Highway. But the only meeting we've had as elected members was, I think, in December. It's been certainly nothing since Christmas. And we were told flatly that we're not considering anything other than immediately either side of the river, where the bridge starts and finishes. We're not looking at Curtin Highway, Curtin Avenue. We're not looking at the North Fremantle Town Centre. It's purely a bridge across the river. And that's really the sticking point, I think. And since then, the whole thing's been confidential. So we know no more about it than anybody else.
Well, we the citizens are very interested to know more about it, and hopefully this will start to be revealed before it's too late. But just staying then with North Fremantle, what is the sort of vision, going back to the first time you were elected to council and there were issues in North Fremantle, as well as later on, what were the sorts of visions that people had then and still hold dear today? What could the centre, town centre there look like?
Well, if you think back to 1993, the town centre was pretty derelict. The town hall was for sale, the old North Fremantle town hall was for sale. Almost all the shops were owned by one family, and they were almost entirely antique shops, I don't remember that.
Yes, I remember.
And it's been quite a remarkable renaissance, and I think not necessarily because of council planning. I mean, you tried to plan for those things, and it's like South Fremantle. I mean, the vibrancy of South Fremantle now is not a direct result of council planning. It's a combination of a whole lot of factors. So I think the big success story is how the town centre has reinvented itself. The big issues have always been connections across. Everything in the peninsula goes north-south, and very little goes east-west. So you've got that ridiculous crossing at the railway station, which nobody can explain. You have to do a sort of 200-metre dogleg to get across the railway line. So just trying to think. Now, I live near the river, and I think I have to go across 12 lanes of road to get to the beach in a 12-minute walk. So not all main roads, but there are 8 lanes of main road and another 8 lanes of minor roads between a 12-minute walk.
Yes.
And three railway lines.
Yes.
So that's probably the biggest issue, and we've now got massive development proposals for the old Caltex site. That's with the WA Planning Commission at the moment to try and rezone that site to mixed use and residential. And they will want to do pretty high density, I imagine. That does, however, give us the possibility of getting connection from the Old Town Centre through to the beach.
That really becomes an interesting question. Every time one drives, say, to Leighton or to Port, leaving aside Port's particular problems with the coastal erosion there, and you go down Tideman Street from the Queen Victoria intersection and so on, you just think to yourself, now how can you do this? You've got a railway line which intersects it all, you've got trucks going into the port, you've got the town centre surviving nicely with a range of uses and restaurants and a great wine store and all of that. But is there some obvious proposition that you would put forward to solve those problems? Would it be a flyover that took you conveniently to the beach?
What we put to Main Roads in this December meeting was, if you Curtin Avenue currently finishes at North Mantle Railway Station and then swings towards the beach to become Port Beach Road, if that was to continue on and become the new bridge, so the traffic would divert off Stirling Highway onto that road. So traffic going into Fremantle would go down Curtin Avenue behind the town centre, over a new bridge into Fremantle. Traffic going bypassing Fremantle would go on the Stirling Highway and go over the Stirling Bridge. But they're not prepared to look at any of that, so that the traffic going into Fremantle will continue to go through the town centre. And the traffic's at a standstill quite a lot of the time, you know, so fumes belching out. Now, Tideman Road is the problem. As long as the port stays where it is, we thought one of the possibilities when Row 8, 9 was being talked about, we never got any answer as to how the road would get from Marmion Street to the port. So we never ever got an answer to that. They talked about having a traffic light free road all the way into the port, but no. The only possible scenario we could see was that you would come off the Stirling Bridge, continue north to the top of the town centre, and then swing around, possibly on a bridge, around the whole of the town centre. So the whole town centre would be surrounded by this freeway, and now you have to have sound walls on the freeway, so, and then swing round back down Port Beach Road and into the port. And that's the only scenario that could possibly fit the description of saying we have to have a road with no intersections or traffic lights all the way from the airport to the port. That was never confirmed as the possibility, but the council employed some engineers as consultants at the time to say what could be done, and that's the only way they could see it, because apart from everything else, you've got to keep the road open whilst you do it. So you can't put Tideman Road onto flyovers or tunnels whilst keeping it open. So that's a pretty horrendous scenario for the town centre. You know, it'd be surrounded by a freeway with sound walls, a bit like the airport road. So, you know, as long as the port stays where it is, I don't think there's any good solution. You know, it's Tideman Road or it's worse. You know,
and the port, do North Fremantle people in particular have strong feelings about what's happening or might happen?
My feeling is that the majority of people in North Fremantle would prefer the port to be scaled down or to go. That's not the council's view officially, but that seems to be particularly people who bear the brunt of the traffic impacts with the North Bank particularly. I mean, they're sitting down below road level, surrounded by two bridges and a road with all the trucks. And it's all combined with that. We use the worst diesel in the world. We don't have any real controls on pollution. There's no progress towards even cleaner diesel, let alone electric trucks. Now, it could be all different if we had, electric trucks running in convoy at night, fairly quietly. It could be very different. But so long as we just have growth in diesel trucks and so on, I don't think people would want to see it stay.
Well, I've always been interested to try and, I suppose in planning or generally in urban terms, describe the different parts of the municipality of Fremantle. South Fremantle, for example, seems like a wonderful hodgepodge of buildings and mainly residential and some old bits and pieces here, which has sort of just slowly but organically developed over time. How does one describe North Fremantle? Because there's some really beautifully built up places near the river. There's some historic homes. There's the strip we've been talking about in the centre on Queen Victoria Street. How do you describe it?
I think it's quite difficult. I mean, I think what's happening at South Fremantle is quite remarkable. It's as you say, an organic growth, you know, partly due to council policy, but I'd say mainly not. Its location, the fact the terrain is flat, it's good for cycling and all that. North Fremantle's the opposite. It's extremely difficult. Cycling, walking, not a great place for ageing in place.
And the streets go in all directions in North Fremantle.
I think it's interesting. If people go back to the original townscape, it was quite different. I mean, Harvest Road went right the way through to Queen Victoria Street. And because there were a lot of houses demolished to create the Stirling Bridge.
Yes.
And there also used to be another 600 houses between the town centre and the beach, which is
amazing,
still shown
isn't it,
on
when
the,
you think about it?
No, it's still shown on the map. You can still see all the lot lines. That was demolished for the port. So it was a thriving community.
Its own municipality at one time, wasn't it?
It was its own municipality, yeah, until the 1950s or 60s. So trying to restore that to a town in its own right is very difficult. It's because, as I say, all the emphasis has been on these north-south main transport corridors, and little emphasis on the east-west connections. I mean, between Tideman Road, if you think about it, it's Tideman Road, the next place you can cross the railway is North Fremantle Railway Station, and then the next one is in Mosman Park. Well, the bridge, the footbridge, yeah.
Yes.
So you've got the footbridge, the old Leighton Railway Station. So it's a lot of, it's about 3 kilometres with very little opportunity to cross. So I think that's very difficult. And there are a lot of, I think it's fair to say North Fremantle's got the highest proportion of high density development in Fremantle. You know, if you take about North Bank, Leighton and the Tasker buildings together, it's probably about 50% of the population living in higher density than is normal for Fremantle. And so that's quite a different kind of mix than the traditional community that used to live there.
Yes, well, the Sydney Harbour phenomenon, if you can see the river, then you build up to make sure you can keep seeing it.
Yeah, and I think traditionally it would have been a lot of very much a working class place with a lot of people working on the port. That's gradually eroded, and a lot of the new development is very expensive, attracting people from the western suburbs rather than more traditional Fremantle residents. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of challenges there. One of the things I've been trying to do for years is try to improve the crossing at the railway station, but again, it's all too difficult. We still keep working on it, but we're hoping to resolve that as the next stage of the cycle path, because the cycle path is due to get to North Fremantle Railway Station by about January next year, and then in the next phase is from North Fremantle to Fremantle, which is tied up with the new bridge. We're hoping at that point we can get the crossing improved as part of the cycle network.
Well, North Fremantle has so many beautiful, secret, hidden little parts, not the least of them, that magnificent Gil Fraser Oval.
Yep.
That's just a beautiful little spot there.
I think it's one of the oldest football grounds in Western Australia. Yeah. It's beautiful, and it's of course another issue there, that's in danger of being regularly flooded now, so that's another major problem we have to face. You know, that whole area is only about 1.5 metres above sea level.
Now, Bryn, when did you arrive in Fremantle, North Fremantle?
We first lived in Beaconsfield, so we got here in 1980 after travelling for 2 years, so we left England in 1978. We travelled for 2 years, we got here in 1980, and we lived in Beaconsfield for about the first 10 years, and then moved to North Fremantle in about 1990, been there ever since.
Oh. So, how did you come to Fremantle in that broader sense? What brought you here from England?
Oh, it was completely unplanned. We taught in a school in East London which had a lot of Indian students, and got talking to them, and we thought we'd like to go to India. So we bought a Land Rover and we did the old hippie trail, went to through Turkey and Iran and Afghanistan and got to India. And the plan was to go to India and go back, but everything closed up behind us. Iran, the Shah left, to Egypt, where he died. The Ayatollah took over. Iran closed down. Afghanistan started firing up.
Next port, Fremantle.
And we couldn't go back. But the other issue was it's all but impossible to sell a vehicle in India. You know, it would have been, even though the vehicle was only worth about $4,000, it was $60,000 duty to sell it. And we were very fortunate that whilst we were in South India, Sri Lanka opened up to the importation of vehicles for the first time in 8 years. So it took us about 3 months to sell. But fortunately, we had a diesel Land Rover, and in Sri Lanka, they love Land Rovers. And they can't afford petrol. Diesel was like a hundredth of the price of petrol. So we're very fortunate. And then we had to find somebody who could pay in foreign currency. So it was a massive undertaking. But we had to get somebody to come from Sri Lanka to India to look at it and then arrange the importation of it from India. So it took 3 months, 4 months. That's a pretty amazing experience. And then from there, we applied for... Well, once we were in India, we knew we couldn't go back. We went to the Australian embassy and applied for the working holiday visa so we could come to Australia and recoup some money. So it was like a six-month working holiday visa. And in those days, you could apply for residency whilst you were on the working holiday visa. It just ended about then. So now you have to go back to the country you came from and apply from there. So in 1980, you could apply whilst you were here. So we did. They took about 2 years to get residency. And we both had teaching jobs at the time, and I was a maths teacher at the time. There was a shortage of maths teachers, so we qualified for residency. So, yeah, it was, and Fremantle was the first place we landed, and at that point we'd been travelling for 2 years and intended to carry on, you know, through Australia, South America, and go back to England. And we just after 2 years travelling, once you get into a house, and you know, for the first time in 2 years.
Recharging your batteries in a way.
So we stayed, and we've been here ever since. I had two children here, and so it was never actually planned, but it was a very fortunate set of events.
Now, when you first went on the council, and when you came back again for this second stint, were there any differences in what was required of you as a councillor? Did you notice any significant change?
Well, the whole Local Government Act had changed, so that was very different. But the main difference was that in the 1990s, the council was quite divided. You remember the fortnightly bins issue and things, and there was quite a few issues on which councillors disagreed. So there were a lot of issues on which the council was fairly split, and some at times sort of unpleasant situations. Since I've been back on council, it's a much more collegial situation. You know, people are much more respectful and courteous and treat everybody with a fair degree of respect and courtesy. And so pretty well people don't take issues out of the meeting, you know, and carry them on, which tended to happen a bit in the 90s.
You hear a lot of discussion, not so much within local government in Western Australia, but in the local media more generally, and in private conversations, whether there's politics in local government, and whether there ought to be even, and whether people ought to be caucusing the outcomes and bring them to meetings. Is that an issue? Ought it be one?
Well, there certainly was a time in the past when Fremantle Council was very much Labor controlled. I mean, in the 1980s, early 90s, I think that was the case. I've always been interested in politics, but I've always been very wary of political parties. You know, and I think we're seeing now the kind of damage they can do. I don't know what a better alternative is, but I don't think political parties as they're working now is the answer. Obviously, people who are interested in politics and want to be on council are... It's obvious that some of them will be members of political parties. I think it becomes an issue when when you have a sort of caucus of people belonging to one party that maybe have their own separate meetings to decide things before they go to council. I don't know if, I mean, some local governments are obviously much more party affiliated than others. That's not the case in Fremantle, even though that allegation is made by some people. I've never been a member of a political party. I know there are other people on council who haven't, and there are people who are members of parties, and they're quite open about it. So there's no kind of... But I've never been aware of anybody voting a particular way because they were a member of a political party.
You know? Yes. And in your case, did you have any prior involvement in this sort of public life, in any form of sort of governance before you got to Fremantle and eventually stood in the 90s?
I was actually president of the student union, and I went to Queen Mary College, University of London, and I was president of the student union there when I was 19, which was challenging because they had all their decisions were made by public meetings. They had a they had a general meeting every Monday with about 600 people.
It was a plebiscite on everything.
Yeah, and so there was a general meeting every Monday for 2 hours, lunchtime. About 600 people attended, and I had to chair it, so that was interesting.
Well, there's been a lot of people who have found their way from that sort of student politics into sort of the top positions in the country, Bryn.
And then I taught in East London for 8 years in a very difficult school, and was involved in the teachers' union there. Again, that was a lot of party politics involved in that, and I never got involved in that side of it, but I was certainly involved in the teachers' union, and because it was a bit of a battle. Teaching in East London in those days was the height of the sort of racism and, you know, skinheads, and the school I was in was about 30% immigrants, a fair proportion of racists and skinheads, and it was pretty challenging.
I think there's been a few television documentaries made of such places in the years since.
Yeah, well, it was my first year teaching was in a school which was, I don't know, in Britain they had this tripartite system which most local authorities didn't put in place, so that it was like the top third went to grammar school, the middle third went to a modern school, and the bottom third went to a technical school. Right? And,
so who decided on the allocation?
Well, the 11 plus exam, you know.
Right.
So the school, my first year of teaching as an unqualified, untrained teacher was in a school for the least able 30% of the boys in the area. So that was an interesting challenge. And most of them left school at age 14 or 15 without taking any exams at all. So there was, and then after a year, the comprehensivization sort of process was taking place. And the school was on a site with two other schools on a similar site, so we all amalgamated and
suddenly became a comprehensive.
Made a school of 2,300 students, which was which involved the boys' grammar school, the girls' modern school, and the boys' technical school. So it took about 6 years for all that to flow through to become a properly comprehensive school. So
two questions out of that, Bryn, that occur to me as we're chatting and not appreciating that fascinating history and experience you had. One, what effect that may have had on your nation values or new values that you developed, and how that might have brought together a range of skills that you finish up bringing to the Fremantle Council.
Yeah, I've always been a strong supporter of public education and investing in the community, so I suppose that's part of it. When I started teaching, of course, it was a very different political, it was pre-Thatcher, and very different, well, Thatcher was the education minister, not the prime minister, but I think the changes in both Britain and Australia since then are quite profound in terms of moving away from politicians working for the overall good of the community and towards working more for self-interest. You know, I think that's a real retrograde step we've made, and I think Britain's possibly even worse. Australia's bad enough, but I think Britain might even be worse.
And when it comes to those life experiences and professional experiences that you had, and you go on to council, what did you see yourself as as bringing to council when you first went on, and what do you bring today with that background and experience?
Well, on a practical level, I'd been involved in computer education for a long time when I came on council, and it was at the time when councils, you know, libraries were getting automated, council was getting computerised for the first time, so I was able to drive a bit of that agenda, you know, getting the internet into Fremantle fairly early in, through the AMCOM network. I was involved in the first automation of the library, so I suppose those kind of things. I was working at Notre Dame University when I was elected to council, so I was developing the IT at Notre Dame at the same time as I was on council. So I was in touch with a lot of kind of innovative companies and things, so that was a part of it. I think also I was elected the first time on a commitment to the precinct system, which didn't happen then for about another 4 or 5 years. But I actually dug out one of my first election flyer, which talked about the precinct system from North Sydney and so on, and trying to introduce that here. And I was very strongly committed to that. I wasn't successful in introducing it for the first few years, but then a separate group of people kind of came in and eventually got introduced. And I think it works better in some parts of Fremantle than others, but I think it's basically a good system for getting input into council processes.
It seems to be. I don't hear people bad-mouthing the precinct system as such.
No, it's just in some places it works better than others. It depends. You need renewal all the time.
Yes.
You need to get reasonable attendances at meetings. And I think South Fremantle and Wycombe Valley seem to be the most active ones. North Fremantle is not as active as it used to be, though I think that might be firing up again now with the bridge. There's a lot of activity now created by the bridge design, and trying to grow that process into a more holistic design for North Fremantle. Yeah, so and generally when I first went on council, there was very little consultation, very little notification, so that was a major part of it. You know, there were no signs on development sites, no
notices that there was a planning application.
Well, immediate neighbours were notified in a letter, and that was about it. So there was a whole revamp of that whole consultation process and advertising process, which I played a role in, and that was one of the things I was most interested in, because I mean, there would be things like a four-storey building just appeared about three doors away from me, you know, and nobody knew anything about it, you know, in the early 90s. And everybody was pretty shocked when they started going above the roof line, and then when we inquired, you know, literally only the two immediate neighbours had been informed.
When you look at the circumstances, well, you can go beyond Fremantle, can't we? The whole planet is in with this COVID pandemic running at the moment. Are you starting to think to yourself, with the benefit of age, experience and a little bit of time where you can sit like we are in a South Fremantle park at the moment with the birds tweeting and thinking about our grandchildren and looking at the blue sky, that things might actually be changing for the way local governments like City of Fremantle work in the future? Do you have a sense that it's just going to be business as usual, or are we going to see real changes?
No, well, I'd hope we see real change. I was quite impressed with the state government's stimulus package that was released yesterday, with a reasonable emphasis on regional tourism and renewable energy and off-grid things. I thought that was the right direction. I don't see the same thing happening at the Commonwealth level. I remember back to the meetings we were having when, just before lockdown, and that sense of dread, absolute dread that everyone had. The initial assumptions would be we'd be in serious lockdown for 6 months, and you know, partial lockdown for maybe 18 months. And I think we should be very grateful for what's happened in Western Australia. I think the news out of Victoria today is pretty terrible, and we need to be very careful to maintain this. But I think in terms of Fremantle, that there is an opportunity to kind of reinvent ourselves. And
in what way?
Well, ironically, the very day that the 2,000 Departments of Community Workers moved into Fremantle was the very day that hospitality was closed down. And now we didn't expect to get out of that for 6 months. Now we're only like 3 months now and we're out of it. And
things are bubbling in Fremantle, aren't they?
And I've been interested, just thinking about this, that you know, there's a lot of people in Western Australia who are wealthy who haven't been affected negatively. I mean, like, I don't think retired people, for instance, have not been anywhere near as negatively affected as other people. So obviously a lot of people have been very, very negatively affected. There are also a lot of people that would have been going to Bali twice a year or going skiing or whatever who can't do that anymore. So there is somewhere, there's a lot of money in the economy that and people will be treating themselves. Now, that was very evident yesterday. I had a walk around Fremantle yesterday for a couple of hours and places were busy and the more expensive places were very busy. You know, the expensive wine bars and the expensive restaurants. Jar Jar Bull was packed, for instance. The Whispers wine bar was packed. And so I get the sense that people are kind of treating themselves a little bit, you know, with the, you know, the money they're not spending on their overseas holidays. And so Fremantle might benefit from that, and I hope we do. Gives us a chance to attract people back who haven't been here. We've got our sort of stimulus package is actually discussing the final thing tonight, and it'll be released over the next couple of weeks. But we've had three committees working, looking at infrastructure, community, and economy. And the final meeting to go through those documents is tonight, and then they'll be released. And just for an example, I mean, one of the things is to move more towards smaller family-friendly events that can be easily moved and modified rather than big events that are planned a year ahead.
And then get cancelled completely.
And then get cancelled. So the Street Arts Festival, for instance, there was really no saving to the council or the ratepayers from cancelling that because all the money was pretty much spent. So.
And Hidden Treasures has just been announced. Just
back and again, that's the kind of thing that could easily be moved to the next week or to different venues, or and there's no massive expense in cancelling it. So I thought that the Lego Adventure thing was the first of the thing. You know, that was the people in Fremantle that during that time was equivalent to a weekend in January. You know, so it had a very significant effect for a very small budget and a very simple idea. So we're looking around for a lot more things like that. Small, agile, family-friendly, easily cancelable, easily moved, you know, that kind of thing for the next maybe 18 months. I mean, Falls Festival have said they'll come in January, but I don't know, they'd have to have a contingency plan. They have to be ready to change.
You have to be able to bring people in to the state for a start.
Yeah. So.
Although, what's wrong with a Falls Festival made up of West Australian artists?
Yeah, or you may find that you can get artists in and quarantine them, and they can stay in Western Australia for 3 months playing around. So there was, I think there is opportunities for Western Australia and particularly for Fremantle, but it's out of a fairly tragic situation, and it's obviously getting worse. So I don't think we should be in any way complacent.
No, we can't be. In terms of Fremantle's economy more generally, I mean, obviously there are never, you know, simple solutions to these things. There's no one thing that's going to make Fremantle the regional centre it liked to think it once was. But do you have thoughts about that? I mean, obviously bringing in the departments into King's Square and having the official opening last week, 1,900 people makes a difference. Does it just have to be more of that, or are there other things
and,
that can be
and
done?
And residential, I think the key bit that's it's very good that the government announced that they're going ahead with the Bert Street development. That's about 250 units of accommodation of various kinds.
Yes.
And that's within that kind of 10-15 minutes walk of the town centre, which is the key part.
Down the hills, is it?
Yeah, and so, I mean, I think we've been saying for a long time, we need about 5,000 more people living within about 10 minutes walk of the town hall. The population of Fremantle a few years ago was only 800. If you take the centre of Fremantle, like 10 minutes walk from the town hall, there are only about 800 people living inside that circle, which is hopeless for the 7-day economy. So there have been improvements since then, heirloom apartments, live apartments. The one that's being built on the old Spotlight site is happening.
Yes.
There's a lot of things, but interestingly, since I've been back on council, it's 5 years, I'd say there are about 500 apartment units that have been approved which haven't been built. You know, so there's that's just in the centre of Fremantle.
Well, I suppose to a large extent that's the way the development industry works, and things like COVID certainly wouldn't fill the banks with great enthusiasm.
And so that's going to be a hard one, because the whole of the heirloom apartments and live apartments is only about 500 people. It's incredible how much you have to build to get 5,000 people within that central area.
Well, you want to sort of get everything else right, don't you? The question of design, location, public space and the like. But in terms of central Frio, but not confining it to that, are there particular developments, projects, works that you would love, if you were the emperor for the day, to see happen?
Well, there's the hotel next to the old boys' school has been on and off for several years. That would be a big improvement. That's a combination of apartments and hotel rooms and retail. I think the retail will be a challenge now.
We're very lucky, Bryn. We've just got the City of Fremantle Garden Department have turned up to the park. So we'll do our best for a moment.
That would be one. There are two apartment blocks next to St. Pat's which didn't get built. That would be about 300 dwellings between them. They'd be in the right sort of location.
And, well, those things are probably just going to happen naturally, I suppose. There's no basic opposition to those developments.
Well, they're all approved, yeah. They're all approved. They just need to be built. And that's the frustrating thing, that we've got vacant lots within 10 minutes walk of the centre of town, and that's really the key missing part of the puzzle, you know, is to live, work and play.
We'll just walk and talk, shall we, because I think we're about to be invaded. But in terms of the topic that we've sort of skirted around, namely the port itself.
Yep.
You mentioned earlier there's the Fremantle Council position in relation to that, but there's also distinct regional Fremantle interests. I mean, people in North Fremantle presumably are happy, as you suggested, or many of them are, to see the intensity of what happens at the port reduced.
Yeah, I think so, and I think obviously people love to have the ships coming up and down visible from the ends of the straits. We love to see the cranes operating and all of that, but it seems to me the benefits of the port are full of shared kind of fairly evenly across Fremantle, but the disadvantages are heavily faced. You know, the smell of the sheep ships, the traffic, the trucks is very heavily borne by North Fremantle, you know, so that I think there is a disparity in that. But I mean, my office when I worked at Notre Dame was in Mowat Strait, and it was just always loved just walking out of the street into the street and seeing a ship going across the end of the street.
Astonishing sight.
The bookend of the street, you know, and I'd obviously be a
block of apartments going past you.
Be a shame to lose that. But I mean, there aren't too many places in the world now where the main port is in the centre of town, you know, and I think that is unusual. And and we've been promised the report for a long time now. It's supposed to be coming out this week. Maybe it'll be next week.
But, this is the week, is it?
Well, 2 weeks ago there was rumours of within 2 weeks, so I'm not sure where we're at. It was supposed to be January, so I don't know where we are with that, but again, it seems quite strange to me to be discussing new bridges and railway lines within a few weeks of an announcement about the future of the port. It seems to be
the
wrong way around.
They could impact each other, couldn't they?
Yeah, obviously, yeah. So the disruption of having a rail line through Fremantle for... if the port is moving within 10 years, seems to be, something. I would have thought if people thought the port was moving within 10 years, they'd probably just rather put up with it rather than make major changes now,
is
my feeling.
But if the port were going, you'd redesign the bridge infrastructure differently.
I would think so, yes. But the council's had three representatives on the working party, but it's been treated as confidential. So. Despite promising consultation in January, that nothing's happened at all, and I suspect the consultation will be about what do you think of this proposal, and this is the only proposal we've got.
Do you want it painted purple, or do you want it painted white?
Yeah, it'll be, you know, if you want to keep, do you want to keep the north end of the old bridge or the south end of the old bridge, and what sort of paintings do you want on the tiles, that kind of thing.
Well, on those slightly cynical notes, Bryden, we might draw this very interesting conversation to an end. Thank you very much for coming and joining me and discussing your life and times, particularly on the council.
Thank you, it's been very interesting. Thanks.